Welcome to Trial Site News Podcast Series. We are honored to host Dr. Pierre Corey, Associate Professor of Medicine at St. Luke's Aurora Medical Center, and whom Trial Site News would classify as a pulmonologist and ICU specialist dedicated completely to the COVID-19 patient. He was educated at the St. George University Medical School and has been board certified by the American Board of Internal Medicine in internal medicine, pulmonary disease, and critical care medicine. Now, recently, the topic of a Trial Site News article, Dr. Corey is an active contributor to real-world-based COVID-19 protocols based on extensive, unfolding, and rich evidence from the clinic during the pandemic. One alliance, known as the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, or the FLCCC, is a topic of discussion today. So, Dr. Corey, welcome.
Thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be here and talk about COVID and try to figure this out.
The pleasure is ours. So let's jump right into this. I want to jump into some of the observations uncovered by us here at Trial Site News. First and foremost, we are picking up signals that major research sponsors, from pharmaceutical companies to government-organized research initiatives, don't appear to be at all interested in unfolding real-world and clinical trials, not to mention substantial observational health data showcasing the benefits of ivermectin. Why do you think that is?
So, you know, I'm going to first preface that by saying I am not an expert in answering that. I can only do it by observation from where I sit in society, which is, you know, I'm in the healthcare system. I've worked for many large institutions, some major academic medical centers. But the way that government works around healthcare and what those healthcare authorities or institutions do, it's not clear to me. But from the outside, what I've observed is, it seems that, it's stating the obvious, it seems that they're looking for big solutions, right? And I think they're listening to maybe business interest, looking for, you know, systematic population solutions, something novel, right? And so that seems to be their first way to address this. So for instance, this overemphasis on a new vaccine, developing vaccines, and or these novel medications. The question I have, so I'm going to answer a question with a question, is the things that I wonder about is, where is the division of the CDC or the NIH, which is more like us in our group, which is a small group dedicated to looking at maybe repurposed, readily available, cheap, effective medicines that might have antiviral activity, right? Because that's what our group has done. It's very different than those big institutions where I don't know what their incentives are and what their focus are. They seem to be looking for, like I said, something big and novel. Our group instead, we're small, we are obsessive, we look for solutions, we've done research, we're really experienced at the bedside, we have a lot of knowledge of different therapeutics, and we've treated severe critical illness and severe viral syndromes and bacterial syndromes before. And so we had a very different outlook on how to solve this, and we looked at the tools at hand. I don't know why there isn't a push for doing the, your question was about, like, why aren't there a push for trials on various solutions? I don't know why they're looking for novel stuff when we have so much therapeutics available to us. I'm going to say my concern is, if the major, like, sort of big pharma and governmental institutions haven't done that, I would ask a question, where is the big philanthropy? Right. There's large philanthropic organizations that could have come in and said, you know, this seems to be a readily available novel solution, which has some efficacy. Why aren't they coming in and funding some of these trials?
Right. And at the very least, say from the government side, why not do both?
I totally agree. I don't see those kind of trials. Most of the trials on the sort of the simple, more readily available medicines, it seemed to... at least the ones on the thing that I'm now expert on, which is ivermectin, they seem to be occurring outside of the country. And so I don't know what that block is. I can't profess to be an expert on why those major institutions aren't focusing their activity on what you just said, which is, you know, rolling out trials on readily available medicines that we could test and treat with now.
Now, some have said that more than money, the reasons why not, it's hubris of the medical and research establishment of the first world, example here in the USA, Europe, and so on and so forth, over the pragmatic realities and necessities required in the developing world or so-called low and middle income countries. Do you think that there is any truth to that statement?
The fact that they have hubris. Well, I think it's not only hubris. I do think, yes, that there is this dynamic where, you know, we are so advanced and we have so much knowledge and power and resources that we teach you, you don't teach us, right? So I think there is some of that hubris, or like what we call, I guess, ethnocentricity. But I think that's only part of it. My take on the problem with, for instance, the US and major sort of leading healthcare institutions and bodies like the CDC and the WHO is the way that they work is they make recommendations on treatment, but they do that after accumulating a sufficient body of evidence. Once they get that data and they see and they can interpret and the data is overwhelmingly in favor of a certain treatment, then they will make the recommendation. They do not make recommendations on treatments unless they have that overwhelming data. And in that kind of structure and dynamic, that's really built for peacetime and not for war. And that's where I want to contrast that with what the group that I'm a part of, right? So the Frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance, it first started with our 5 core clinicians. We're supported by some other doctors as well, but we simply focused on how to solve this. We tried to learn everything we could about the pathophysiology. We shared our bedside insights of treating these patients who are terrifically ill and would deteriorate rapidly. We were throwing different things at it. And we saw that they were clotting, they were hyperinflamed, and we were using different medicines. And we very quickly accumulated really good experience and good impacts in interrupting this disease. And the other thing is, we constantly shared data, papers, we were constantly reviewing it and sharing between us. So we were like, whereas those big institutions that you're talking about with the hubris and that are waiting for data to make these proclamations, we were just kind of like, we're more of like a wartime model where like we're a fleet deployed force where we're just accumulating data, what works, what doesn't. There's this paper, there's that paper. And we evolved our protocols over time. And I think our approach is much more effective in this fast moving pandemic and our treatment protocols have shown to be effective. And especially our newest one is just overwhelmingly showing a really big impacts. And so I can't speak about why they're doing the things that they do. I can speak more about how we've done it and how that's been working. That's what I'm expert in, because I've been sitting in this group led by Dr. Paul Marek. And I have to tell you, our treatment protocols are just becoming more and more and more effective. And that's all we're focused on. We're trying to figure, we don't do the research on novel agents. We just use expertise, knowledge of pathophysiology, and the existing available therapeutics. And with those three, we are doing really, really well at treating this disease.
So on that note then, for our audience, could you break down the FLCCC protocol and why you think it's working today?
Yeah. So let me talk about first that as a group, it was Dr. Paul Marek, very famous doctor, you know, one of the probably the most published, what's called intensivist in the world. So we're the core group of us, we're critical care specialists. We work in intensive care units. You know, our predominant expertise is dealing with patients with multiple forms of or numbers of organ failures. So we take care of the sickest of the sick. We're close colleagues and friends with Dr. Marek. And when the pandemic first started to hit the U.S., a couple other colleagues of ours reached out to Paul and said, listen, you know, you got to figure out how to treat this thing. And he called in his close number of colleagues and we formed our group. And I don't know how many months it's been now, but we've just been reading and reading and reading and discussing. And we came up with first one protocol and now more recently, and that's what we're going to talk about today, a more recent protocol. But our first one that we first got a lot of attention to was called the Math Plus protocol. And that's for hospitalized patients. And that's really where our expertise lies, is how to treat the very ill patients whose lungs are starting to fail in the hospital. And the math stands for the first main components, which is methylprednisolone, intravenous ascorbic acid, thiamine, and heparin. We're aggressive with our anticoagulation. We're aggressive with our anti-inflammation with the methylprednisolone as well as the ascorbic acid. And then for organ support, the thiamine. We also would call it the Math Plus because we have a number of other elements. And that protocol has been adopted in varying amounts throughout the world. We're in contact with many different physicians in many countries who found that they've used it to very good effect. When we came out with it, which was around April, I just wrote a review paper. It's about to be published in a week. We have now numbers and numbers of trials which have validated each component. And so like we're very sort of proud that we put that out there. I mean, it's not standard of care. None of the big institutions or healthcare societies adopted it. But it's validated and it's really therapeutic impactful. The hospitals in which we've measured the outcomes far lower than any other published data that we've seen. And so that's the Math Plus protocol. The iMask Plus protocol is the one that we came to recently. And that was really centered around the fact that we discovered the rapidly emerging accumulating evidence on ivermectin, which is so consistent, reproducible, and profound in its efficacy at multiple phases of the disease, we decided to build a new protocol. We call that the iMask protocol, and that's centered around ivermectin and obviously mask with some other supportive medicines like vitamin C, vitamin D, zinc, quercetin, which we know can be effective in optimizing the body before getting ill.
Now, how did you come to terms with this emerging protocol and specifically the role that ivermectin plays in it?
Yeah, so it came about as it really in the last 2 months, I would say 6 weeks, it's been, the time is just going so fast here, but you may or may not know, but in the last 4 to 6 weeks, a number of trials have come out which basically show that almost all of the therapeutics that have been trialed and used by other centers, like the ones that we've used have been validated, but things like tocilizumab, hydroxychloroquine, remdesivir, convalescent plasma, there's been a slew of negative trials showing that all those things aren't working. And you know, we've been keeping track of all the data on all the possible therapeutics. And Alex, I'm gonna say, Dr. Marek, this is about maybe 3 weeks ago, we're reviewing all the trials. We always had ivermectin on there with a question mark. The problem was there was no data on ivermectin. There's no trials being published on ivermectin. But it did seem, like the others, to have some rationale for potential therapeutic efficacy. Dr. Marek noticed when he's looking at, you know, what's out there on ivermectin, this is maybe 3-4 weeks ago, we started to see some studies being posted on clinicaltrials.gov. There was some mentions on trial site news of a couple of studies on preprint servers. And it seemed like everywhere he looked, and this is early on, because we found lots of stuff since 3 or 4 weeks ago. I mean, this the ivermectin data is accumulating rapidly, but he first had like sort of an aha moment, maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, just on like 3 or 4 trials which were lining up as prophylaxis and early treatment. And he said to us, I think this is going to be an effective therapy. We listened and then we started to look. And as a group, we just started reviewing the studies that are coming out. And we just found more and more data. And it's since he first picked up on that signal, it's done nothing but continuously accumulate, all uniformly positive, potent, and profound.
Now, I want to shift a little bit here. I want to talk about hydroxychloroquine. Why do you think so many researchers and physicians embraced hydroxychloroquine early on, only to abandon it seemingly after President Trump discussed the topic? How accurate do you think are the health threats associated with using hydroxychloroquine early on as a treatment? The data is arguably mixed. On the one hand, some studies, especially observational studies, show some promise, while others completely seem to refute the usage.
Yeah, that's a complicated topic. And I'll give you my take on it is that hydroxychloroquine was used for the same reasons why ivermectin was used. It had some, what I would call biologic plausibility. So in the lab, it had some in vitro evidence that it had some antiviral activity. It's a drug well known in the United States. And it seemingly held promise that it might be effective. And it was adopted widely. Listen, when this thing was coming, people were dying. The mortality rates were through the roof. We needed something that might be able to mitigate the morbidity and mortality. And so hydroxychloroquine was widely used. And this is where medical evidence gets a little tough to interpret, right? So when you give it to folks and they get better, you're left wondering, was it the hydroxychloroquine or not? And I think still, even though we've learned not to fall into that trap, I think many doctors still felt that they were using it a lot, patients were getting better, and so it worked. The problem is this, is that when you look at the evidence, there's something called observation control trials and randomized control trials. And the unfortunate thing about that is if you look at the history of medicine, the two trial designs largely reach the same conclusion on average throughout the history of medicine. They usually line up, almost always line up. But with hydroxychloroquine, they didn't. The randomized controlled trials on hydroxychloroquine were uniformly negative. And what's more worrisome, or what's more damning on hydroxychloroquine, it's not that there was no early trial, because lots of times observation control trials are positive because they can be started earlier. Randomized control trials are harder because by the time you get them, patients are to be identified and treated and randomized. It's later in the disease course. So sometimes observational trials are positive, randomized are negative, and everyone's saying it's because the randomized control trials were late. But in the case of hydroxychloroquine, we have trials of post-exposure prophylaxis, early outpatient, and hospital. Negative, negative, negative. The observational control trials are a little bit all over the place. Most of them tend to show a benefit. I happen to be part of a group which looked at the post-exposure prophylaxis trial that was published. And in a post-hoc analysis, it seems that hydroxychloroquine does have some benefit if used very early. I don't think it's a large amount of benefit. It probably prevents some infections. I don't think it makes a big impact on morbidity and mortality. That's my take of the evidence. And it was widely used, widely studied. There's so many trials, but overall, I can't reconcile the fact that there's four randomized controlled trials at three different disease points, and they just don't show effect. The problem is doctors can argue we could argue for hours. Is it the right dose, the right duration? You know, it was too high, too low. The end result is there's probably some amount of signal for hydroxychloroquine. I don't think all the doctors are wrong who think that it works. My take is this, is that it's certainly not potent enough. If it was, we wouldn't have this argument. If you have a strong magnitude of benefit, it wouldn't be buried in all of these conflicting data. It would shine through and be consistent and reproducible. And that's why I'm talking about ivermectin. That's why our group is so impressed with the data behind ivermectin. It's not doing what the data behind hydroxychloroquine was, which is this way and that way and conflicting and not. Hydroxychloroquine has been consistent, reproducible, and large magnitude in multiple phases of the disease.
Now, assuming that we can all collectively get the FDA and the NIH to buy into ivermectin as a support treatment, what would be a path to commercialization? We think this could be important because if a generic company or a specialized branded company such as Progenobiome or Medical in France produce a commercialized treatment with several million patients with economics, it could still be compelling. What are your thoughts on this?
So I'm going to play the idealistic physician here. And I would, if in that situation, let's say everybody agreed that ivermectin was the solution, I would ask the world, can we please for once not try to make money off this solution, okay? And just leave the money to the side, someone donate the resources, and let's make the drug ourselves. Now, the thing is, there is historical precedent for what I'm just about to say. When ivermectin was first invented, and it was shown to be an effective anti-parasite medication. It essentially eradicated some of the most harmful parasites in low and middle income countries, you know, parasites that cause blindness in populations. So there's some populations in Africa where by the age of 40, 50% of the men in society were blind due to onchocerciasis. The drug company Merck, which first isolated and purified ivermectin, they immediately, at the onset, donated millions and millions of doses to WHO programs to treat widespread parasitic infection. It had one of the most humanitarian and long-lasting public health impacts to date. In fact, that's one of the reasons why ivermectin won the Nobel Prize in 2015. So if everybody can agree and validate the data that we're putting forth and we've identified, why can't we do what Merck did back in 1987 and just donated millions of doses to eradicate a public health scourge, which is, you know, widespread parasitic infections? Can we just not commercialize this once? Can we take a break from commercialization and just help humanity that's suffering right now? I mean, again, I hate to sound like a naive, idealistic gentleman, but really, it's somewhat maddening.
It would be wonderful if that was something that
it's happened before. It's not a novel pie in the sky thing. I mean, it's in the historical record. I mean, the drug company Merck, they actually donated. They've been supporting the WHO eradication programs for decades. 3.7 billion doses of ivermectin have been distributed since its inception. It's not a novel thing to distribute it widely. It's on the WHO's list of essential medicines on the globe. And so I don't think we need a new novel antibody, a new expensive vaccine. We have a readily available solution with a long track record. And that's what I hope that's why this could potentially be a solution to this pandemic, a readily available, cheap solution.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about buy-in. How big do you think a phase 3 ivermectin study here in the States needs to be to get the powers to buy in?
So I want to pin down that question of what kind of phase 3. So usually when you say phase 3, it implies a placebo-controlled trial. I want to go back to my point before about the fact that well-conducted observational control trials and randomized control trials generally and almost always lead to the same conclusions. However, they have to be well-designed. You can do propensity matching on the observational side, or you can do randomization with placebo. To do a placebo-controlled trial right now, I could never be an investigator on that because I do not have clinical equipoise. I believe that there's sufficient data that exists now. It just needs further validation because some of it hasn't come through peer review. But there's enough data now to support. You can't do a placebo-controlled trial. If you know it's life-saving, how can you enroll a patient in a pandemic and give them a placebo when you know that this is life-saving from multiple studies that are available from throughout the world? There's studies coming out of Argentina, Egypt, Bangladesh, Brazil, Peru. We know that this stuff is working. And so, again, I'm talking as a naive doctor. I can't imagine doing a phase 3 trial, at least a placebo-controlled one. What I would like is those authorities that you mentioned, do an observational one, a well-designed observational one. We have such big data available to us. We have emergency, electronic health records with millions and millions of patients' data. Why wouldn't we just roll out ivermectin in a series of, let's say, 1,000 patients, just taking it, and then find propensity match, similar patients, identical by name, age, race, sex, comorbidities, and then you can compare the two. That is a totally valid research design, and you don't have to use a placebo. And I'm going to tell you, unlike hydroxychloroquine, the signal would be loud, the benefits would be large and unmistakable. And that's what I would propose, is just do a good observational propensity match trial.
That's a good point. Gauntlet's been drawn. Now, let's shift again. I want to talk about remdesivir. And can you share your thoughts on the true efficacy of this drug and Lilly's monoclonal antibody product just approved via the IND?
So, yeah, it's so hard for me right now because I prefaced one of my earlier answers with the fact that we now have a slew of studies showing that they didn't work. I don't want to sound smarter than everyone, but from the beginning, when remdesivir was first promoted, it didn't pass sort of the first test of biologic plausibility, which is to say, remdesivir is an intravenously administered drug. That's point one. Therefore, it's only going to be administered in the hospital. Point two. And in the hospital, we know it's an antiviral. The viral replication in the hospital phase, which is this inflammatory pulmonary phase, the viral replication is near nil and it's on the wane. There's not a lot of viral replication going on once you're out to like 5, 7, 8 days from first symptoms. So to suddenly start using an intravenous antiviral in hospitalized patients, it doesn't make sense that it would work. Now, the NIH-funded trial, when it was first, came out, it was a game changer. It showed mortality benefits. The final study didn't show mortality benefits. It showed a trend to it. It showed earlier recovery. And so I think that supported the FDA's recommendation. The problem with that is numerous other pretty well-designed trials have not shown the benefit. And then now, very large WHO trial, the Solidarity trial, shows it doesn't work. And in fact, I think it was this morning, the World Health Organization just removed its recommendation for remdesivir, the The FDA has not, the WHO has. So I didn't like its plausibility just on a scientific level. I didn't like that the first early trials out of China were negative. And then the NIH trial was suddenly positive, and the subsequent ones since then are negative. Again, you can have doctors arguing about design, dose, duration, and whatnot. However, if we're arguing that much, it means that if it does have a benefit, it's small. It's not going to be a major impact. And in fact, it's so little, it's now been removed as a recommendation. So that's remdesivir. The antibody also doesn't really possess good plausibility. And I don't know why we're the only ones saying that. Antibodies, when you use antibodies, so things like convalescent plasma or injected antibodies, those have only really been shown to work in blood-borne diseases. This is not a blood-borne disease. It's in the tissue. The viral replication is all in the nasopharynx, and then it spreads into the lungs, either by aspiration. Antibodies do not penetrate into tissues that well. And so why would this this generated or synthetic antibody work? Also, we've already had numbers of other companies with their antibodies fail. Unless I don't know enough about the differences in antibodies, I can't expect why it would work. We've already had similar products fail.
Now, I'm going to shift gears again here. You had a compelling grand rounds recently with a large group of doctors. Can you share with us the plan for how to educate doctors, patients about therapies that could have therapeutic potential?
I wish I knew the real answer to that. All I know is the efforts. We just keep putting in the efforts. I think we get varying results, but you know, we have our website, which is not the greatest way to propagate medical information and expertise. We've always believed that our credentials, our sort of reputations, and our longstanding careers would be enough to sort of get attention and be able to send out good information. But there's so much noise right now and too many people claiming too many things that I think it gets lost. So we just try to put out good, rational, scientific sort of reasoning and insight. We've written a number of papers. I think it's been the most productive period of my life. I know I've published maybe four or five papers and where we've reviewed the pathology of the disease. We've reviewed the evidence behind the therapeutics, and we're going to continue to do so. You know, the paper that I just published on or put up on a preprint server, we think that's the best way to disseminate good knowledge because it's a scientific review of the emerging evidence behind ivermectin. And it basically concludes, based on the available evidence, it concludes that ivermectin would be a global solution to the pandemic if it underwent widespread use and distribution. And that's a scientific conclusion. It's not an opinion. We're not promoting anything. We're not making money off of anything. We have no interest, conflicts of interest, and we just want to help. And based on our expertise and our review and interpretation of the existing evidence, that is our message that we want to put out there, is that ivermectin is a profound prophylactic agent and early and late treatment agent.
Now, we know that you collaborated with Dr. Paul Merrick. Do you both have plans to expand the education of this important protocol, evidenced by emerging trials, observational data, and case series, and a growing movement of folks that seek lower cost economical options for this disease?
Well, absolutely. So collaborating with Paul, I would say, Paul and I are very close, and he's the leader of our group. He brought us together. We talk on the phone five times a day. The group of us, we exchange probably 30 emails a day and read papers. And so our work will continue as it has for 7 months. My second and third jobs was, my first job is an ICU doctor in a COVID unit. My second job is learning and reading and answering Paul's emails about every article on COVID and then having discussions. But we're going to continue this work. And what's also great about a group like us is that we're fast and flexible and we evolve. And so we're constantly reviewing the emerging data. In fact, the paper that I'm about to submit to a journal, I put it on the preprint server. It's very hard to submit to a journal. You know why? Because not 12 hours goes by where I don't get new evidence, new data coming from somewhere in the world that I want to incorporate in the paper. And I have the feeling that if I publish this paper today, in 3 weeks, there's going to be a lot of data that I'm going to miss. And so we're trying to keep up and evolve our treatment protocols and the strength of our recommendations with all the emerging data. So just know that Paul, myself, the other members of the group, Joseph Rowan, Jose Iglesias, we're all, and Umberto Maduri, we're all constantly at work on this.
Fantastic. And finally, are you finding doctors or researchers generally open to discuss the frontline COVID-19 Critical Care Alliance?
Well, I would say, I have a very, my perspective is those that are willing to discuss are willing to discuss. We're not really hearing from those. We haven't gotten emails attacking us. In fact, almost everybody who interacts with us tells us they appreciate our knowledge, our recommendations, our insights, our expertise, and our reviews of the evidence. And so we've gotten nothing but continuous support and shared experiences with using our protocol from doctors all around the world. So it's been largely positive. However, I can't give you data on how many people are using Math Plus. I could give you an anecdote. So my wife is a pulmonary critical care doctor as well. And she was in the ICU last week and she took a patient in transfer from Northern Wisconsin. And in the history of this patient that got transferred, it said that the patient had received the Math Plus protocol from some random hospital in Wisconsin. So I don't know, we like that little piece of data there, but it's hard to tell how many people are really listening and employing some of the insights and recommendations that we shared.
Fantastic. Well, doctor, thank you so much for taking time out of your busy schedule. We really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks for having me.